This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Conventional wisdom says it's going to be a pretty easy choice: bankruptcy or billions more in federal aid. Today is the day when GM and Chrysler lay their cards on the table. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue, fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective at speakingoffaith.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 17th of February today. And by the looks of it, today could not have come soon enough for what is left of the American auto industry. General Motors and Chrysler are due to submit their survival plans to the Treasury Department today. These are the plans that were required as part of the $17.5 billion bailout that Detroit got just before Christmas. The two companies have been negotiating with their unions and their bondholders to cut costs and reconfigure their debt without a whole lot of luck, it ought to be said. We don't know many of the details just yet. Early word is that Chrysler wants another $5 billion in government money. It's going to lay off another 3,000 workers and cut back to just three models. And that does fit pretty well with consensus, drastically smaller companies. So, anybody out there interested in buying part of a deeply troubled car company? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more.
GM wants to spin off or sell subsidiaries like Sweden's Saab or Germany's Opel so it can focus on the U.S. market. But so far, no buyers. Tim Urquhart is analyst for IHS Global Insight. He says other car companies don't see much future in partnering with Opel or Saab.
GM Europe's been a lot more sort of financially viable than GM US, but the problem for Opel and Saab is, you know, if they are spun off into individual units, they lose the global sort of reach and the global power of GM in terms of, you know, their huge sort of vehicle research and development, their huge sort of buying power in terms of components.
Another option, a private buyer. But that didn't work very well for Cerberus Capital, which bought Chrysler. So Urquhart says that leaves a government solution.
In Germany, the various regional governments where the four Opel plants are looking at ways of taking ownership, but that's a very, very difficult plan to pull off. You know, do these guys want to be getting into sort of owning a car company? But, you know, there's 24,000 jobs at stake, so, you know, they're trying all the options.
Still, Ron Kleinbaum, a former GM employee and now consultant, says the overseas culture at GM could prove to be an asset for buyers.
The people overseas are much more business-focused. They're much more performance-oriented, much closer to the marketplace. They have very good relations with dealers and their workforce, whereas in North America, there tends to be very hostile relations with both the dealers and the workforce.
Still, right now isn't such a good time to be selling cars or car companies. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The stimulus plan is now official. President Obama signed the $787 billion package in Denver today, and he will be back tomorrow with more economic recovery news, a proposal to help millions of homeowners fend off foreclosure and, you know, just for good measure, stabilize the housing market while he's at it. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to find out whether one plan can do all that.
President Obama wants to put a shiny hardwood floor under falling real estate prices. Obama's plan aims to reduce some mortgage payments and stabilize the market. Guy Sakala is publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He says in this economy, more people could lose their jobs and get behind on their mortgages, compounding the foreclosure crisis.
I don't think there's any solution that can really put a significant dent in it. That doesn't mean we don't try to limit the problem any way we possibly can.
Notice he said limit the problem, not solve it. Sakala says the housing market has to work out some of its own kinks, but that's painful. Morningstar analyst Eric Landry says President Obama's plan could minimize that pain.
Maybe the government will be able to put off some of these foreclosures so that the market could reach equilibrium a little bit less painfully so.
But most of us are feeling no pain, as far as housing goes. We're not in danger of foreclosure. How would a stable housing market help us? Alan Mendelowitz is director of the Federal Housing Finance Board. He says, look at how falling home prices affect the big economic picture.
People who see their asset values deteriorate feel poor and they spend less, and they create a vicious spiral that adds to the downward momentum in the economy.
And Mendelowitz says if your bank knew the price of your house would remain fairly stable, you'd have a better chance at refinancing or getting a home equity loan. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Whatever benefit California stands to get from the stimulus package is probably already spent. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is set to lay off 10,000 state workers today. He's also going to bring all public works projects to a halt. California will also delay billions of dollars in payments to contractors, counties, and social service agencies. You'd think a $42 billion deficit would get the legislature to do something, too. But no. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports that California may be the best example so far of how not to guide a state through a financial crisis.
Iris Lav doesn't have much sympathy for the so-called Golden State. The deputy director of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says yes, 45 other states are running deficits too. But California voters, she says, brought some of this mess upon themselves. First, she says, it's one of the very few states that requires a two-thirds majority to pass a state budget.
That is something that just begs for what's often called the tyranny of the minority, of very small number of legislators can hold up the budget.
And despite California's go-with-the-flow reputation, when it comes to state government, rigidity is more like it. Scott Pattison, executive director at the National Association of State Budget Officers, says years of voter ballot initiatives have ended up tying the state's hands in times of crisis.
Very little of the budget is actually flexible discretionary funds. And as a result, when you have an economic downturn and you have shortfalls, it really becomes difficult to make the political decisions where to cut or where to increase taxation if you have to or want to.
One of those ballot initiatives, Prop 98, may inadvertently prevent California from using federal stimulus money for the public schools. Prop 98, by the way, was passed to make sure the schools got enough state support after the most famous initiative of all, Prop 13, limited property taxes, the main source of school funding. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Just like you'd probably never heard the name Bernie Madoff till a month or two ago, I'd guess most of you have never heard of a guy from Texas named Alan Stanford before either. So get ready for the headlines. Today, the SEC charged Stanford and three of his companies with, quote, massive ongoing fraud. The damages on this one is $8 billion on a scheme involving bogus certificates of deposit. If you've been worrying that you missed the market bottom, today should have taken care of that for you. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back before Christmas, and for months before that, actually, there were two big arguments against a bankruptcy filing by one of the big car makers. One being, who'd buy a car from a bankrupt car company? And the other being, it wouldn't be just GM or Ford going under. It'd be the thousands of suppliers that sell the parts that cars are made of. Two-thirds of everything in a car that rolls off a big three production line is actually made by those thousands of auto parts companies. They're family-run businesses and big multinationals alike. They employ almost 75% of all the auto workers in this country, and they, in turn, depend on products from other companies. Marketplace's Elisa Roth went to Michigan to see the chain reaction that's been set off by Detroit's problems firsthand.
The headquarters of Dirksen Screw Products is in Shelby Township. It's a quiet suburb north of Detroit. Cliff Dirksen's father and uncle started the business 70 years ago. Back then, they were making parts for airplanes and munitions in World War II. It's still a family business, but these days Dirksen's products mostly end up in cars and trucks.
All over the vehicle, in the engine, transmission, seats, recliners, steering column.
These aren't the kinds of things you buy at your local auto parts store, and you probably wouldn't recognize them if your mechanic said he needed to replace one. Think small metal tubes, finger width, maybe a knuckle long. They're cut to precise specifications, threading, holes, grooves, but they start out as
bars of steel, brass, aluminum, stainless steel,
which are stacked on long wooden shelves that run almost to the ceiling on one side of the plant. Squat machines grind the metal bars down and then cut them to size. But the day I visit, only about a third of the machines are running. And it's been like that for a while. Dirksen's biggest customer is Chrysler.
Our sales are down probably 50 to 60% from their normal levels.
Like most parts suppliers, Dirksen's in the middle of the supply chain. So slow business for him means slow business for the company's downstream. He's buying fewer raw materials, and he's sending fewer of the parts he makes on for finishing and coating and other treatments. But business is slow upstream, too, and Dirksen worries about his customers going out of business and still owing him money.
We've had three of those in the last 3 or 4 months, and that's where you really have to watch your inventory, make sure you have as little as possible, but are still able to meet the requirements.
He's started limiting the credit he'll extend to some clients, and he pays a lot of attention to how much cash is coming in and when. He chases down customers who pay late, and a couple of times he's even stopped shipment of his parts until he got paid. Parts makers like Dirksen sell to the next level up the supply chain, the ones that are a step or two closer to parts the average driver would recognize. The slowdown in the auto industry has cut into their business, too. Autoliv is a big Swedish company that makes seatbelts and airbags, and the company just laid off blue-collar workers at one of its plants in Utah and several white-collar workers in Michigan. It's also scaled back hours at one of its Michigan research and development facilities. Art Blanchford's in charge of the GM unit at Autoliv.
So we're only open 4 days a week in our technical center and paying everybody 20% less because we can't afford to do more than that.
Consumers are buying fewer cars, so almost all the automakers extended the traditional Christmas time shutdowns at their plants. And with no orders coming in, the parts suppliers followed suit. Most of them, including Autoliv, still aren't running at capacity. But under capacity might just be the least of their worries. Suppliers usually get paid 60 days after they deliver their products. It'll soon be 60 days since those extended shutdowns, and suppliers are waiting to see how much money they'll get from companies above them in the supply chain. If it's too little, they might not have enough cash to stay in business. In Shelby Township, Michigan, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Granted, now is probably not the time a lot of people are going to rush out and buy the latest gadget or gizmo, but recessions are often a time of great innovation, and there are some nifty new tech creations out there. Kevin Pereira is here again with us from G4 Television. Welcome back, Kevin.
Pleasure to be back.
I was actually going to say it's been a long time since you've been on, but frankly, it's been me that's been gone.
You've been working while you're away. I've been bringing the gadgets, but it's good to have you back because I have some exciting stuff for you.
All right, well, give it up. What's item one today?
Item one is something that I think I'm going to have to sell you on because you're already looking at it a little confused and concerned. This is the Samsung MBP200 projector. And for those who can't see, which is everybody at home, I'm holding something about the size of a deck of cards. Maybe a little slimmer.
Projector as in a projector.
As in like something you might have to lug around in a briefcase and hook up to do a presentation. And this is using Texas Instruments Pico technology, which basically means they've miniaturized a projector.
All right. So just for the record, I mean, I'm shining it on a wall maybe 8 feet away. It's a nice, clear, crisp image. It looks great. It's a fun little toy. Sell me, baby, because I don't know what I would use this for in my everyday life.
What really interests me about this technology is, look, I don't give presentations at all. I haven't had to actually do the elevator pitch for a movie or a series in this town, believe it or not. But in the near future, we're going to see this Pico projector technology built into cell phones. And that is when you're going to see it take off. I saw this at CES a few years ago, and I said—
The Consumer Electronics Show, yeah.
Yes, and I said, if I have a piece of media on my iPhone and I want to share it with friends, we all have to huddle around this screen like, you know,
point.
Like hobos around a flaming barrel, if
right.
you will. And now we hit a button and we project it up to 50 inches.
Give me the consumer details. How much is it going to cost? And readily available, right?
It will be readily available. The problem is right now there's no price announced. I'm going to guesstimate you're going to see this around $300 to $400.
This actually will be the first time you've ever sold me anything.
All right. Is there a ribbon or a prize?
No,
or
but we'll have you back in a moment.
Oh, good. Thank you.
What else do you have?
I just wanted to bring in this interesting camera. This is a Sony CyberShot. I know you love sliding things and opening them and hearing them click.
Ooh, so wait, here. All right. Well, that's a fairly standard.
I figured you'd be sold right there. But this CyberShot, it looks like any old Sony camera. This is a DSC G3 Wi-Fi camera.
Right.
So it's got a 3.5-inch touchscreen on the back.
Touchscreen, very nice.
Really, really easy to navigate. But what separates this from the other pack of cameras is the Wi-Fi connectivity.
Wi-Fi. So I can actually just load it right up to Flickr or whatever, right?
Correct. You can upload directly to sites like YouTube, Dailymotion, Photobucket, Shutterfly, Flickr, et cetera. And so that means not just your photos, but the videos that you take with the camera as well.
Right.
You can literally snap the video, hit a button, and boom, it's on YouTube.
Last but certainly not least, what looks like a little kid's computer. I mean, like a toy.
It is a kid's computer, actually. Yeah, this is a new initiative by Intel. It's called the Classmate PC. And I want to point out right off the bat that Intel is powering these PCs in terms of design only. They've come up with the design and they said, look, we want to make a laptop that's functional for kids 5 to 14 was sort of their target. Windows.
Yeah.
But they wanted to make a computer that could be used for kids in that range, and now manufacturers, independent manufacturers, are actually creating the laptops themselves.
Did you actually say $500?
These are $400 to $500.
Wow.
Yeah, they've got normally they've got webcams, gobs of RAM, at least 60 gigs of storage. But look, I mean, we say $400 to $500 as a kid's computer, but the netbook market for these business professionals that don't want to carry around a full size laptop but don't want to rely on their cell phone. I think this thing is perfect.
This is kind of amazing. I think this is 2 out of 3 now that you've sold me on, because I'm going to have to get my 10-year-old a computer at some point, and I think $500 is a nice price point.
So the only one we failed on was the Sony camera?
I'm a DSLR guy.
To be honest, that's exactly what we said when we reviewed it on our show. But I wanted to bring it to you and at least show you that Wi-Fi is getting crammed into every device now. Look for it in your Sonicare toothbrush very soon.
Absolutely. Kevin Pereira from G4 Television, Attack of the Show is his show. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, recession hits the haven of hedge fund managers.
I felt bad having to lay off employees, but unfortunately there wasn't enough work coming into the office to maintain the salaries. Most of my best clients have been, you know, I guess the bonus babies of times past.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow retreated 297 points today, 3.75%, closed at exactly the same low point it reached 3 months ago, 7,552 the number. The NASDAQ dropped 63 points, 4.1%, finished at 1470. The S&P 500 fell 37 points. That is more than 4.5%, 789, closing below the 800 mark for the first time in 3 months. Nagging worries over deeper global banking troubles helped sink financial shares today. Investors reined in Wells Fargo stock by more than 13%. Shares in Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, and Bank of America all lost more than 12% today. Walmart was the only Dow component that finished in the green. Its fourth quarter profit dropped, but less than investors were expecting. The stock gained more than 3.5% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
from the Marketplace Statebook. Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for January. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke talks about the economy at the National Press Club. And in Phoenix, Arizona, President Obama is slated to announce his plan to help homeowners facing foreclosure. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hollywood and the movie industry are nothing if not sensitive to the needs of the publicity machine. And that machine really gets fired up when it smells weakness, which it does in the case of the Academy Awards. Last year, the Oscars broadcast drew a record low 32 million viewers. So with just 5 days left until the 2009 ceremony, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences and ABC, which will broadcast the awards, have come up with a plan. It's a variation of the old showbiz adage, always leave them wanting more. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
This year, Joan Rivers will have less opportunity for exchanges like this.
I am sitting here with Naomi Watts, who said, what did you just say, you crucify me?
Yeah, she crucified me last year, so I'm terrified.
And well, you should be, because look how you pulled yourself together this year, and I like to think it's me.
The Academy has asked some of the awards presenters to stay off the red carpet. The idea is to leave some surprises for the main event. But Marisa Guthrie of Broadcasting and Cable says the Academy risks offending the fashion industry by pulling the red carpet from under some actresses.
I mean, they're not going to stand up at the podium if they get an award or present an award and say who designed their dress. I mean, that information comes on the red carpet.
She says designers will miss that publicity. But Jane Ubell-Meyer isn't so sure. Her company makes celebrity gift bags for events, including the Oscars. She says delaying the first glimpse of certain celebrities and their gowns could be a boon for designers.
Now there'll be a spotlight on those that were not on the red carpet, and you'll see it in the magazines as here's the big reveal.
She says all the print publicity will live on for months as people leaf through People and InStyle in doctor's offices. Marisa Guthrie says if the idea is to boost ratings by hiding some celebrities till the ceremony, it's unlikely to work.
Every couple years, there's some sort of musty attempt to get people to tune in, and it's just a bloated telecast. People know it is.
She says one thing that would get millions more viewers to watch would be a year full of blockbuster Oscar-nominated movies. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Greenwich, Connecticut is about an hour's train ride from Manhattan, but it is more than just any other suburb. It's one of the richest towns in this country, in no small part because it's also hedge fund central. Wall Street bankers by the dozen have settled there to run the funds, and until not too long ago, times were flush. But with the billions in hedge fund losses the past couple of years and job cuts on Wall Street, the recession is really starting to be felt. Marketplace's Amy Scott took a road trip to check it out.
It's one of those sparkling winter afternoons. I'm walking up a snowy driveway to a massive colonial-style house.
Welcome to my home.
Gary Silberberg is a realtor in Greenwich. He also owns this place. It's got 5 bedrooms, each with its own bath. And down in the basement, there's plenty of room for amenities.
This is where you'd probably want your home theater with tiered seating. It's set up in such a way that you can probably get 10 to 12 seats in here in theater-style seating.
Silberberg doesn't live here. This is what's known as a spec home.
I built it on speculation that I would sell it. So far, it's not quite the way I had planned it. It hasn't sold as fast as I would have liked.
In fact, it's been on the market for 2 years. Silberberg has knocked $1 million off the price to try to move it. Now he's asking just under $5 million. At that price, he's competing with dozens of homes sitting on the market around Greenwich. A few years ago, they might have sold in a matter of days or weeks. Evan Goldenberg designs high-end wine cellars for homes like these. Business has slowed down so much, he's had to let 2 people go.
You know, I felt bad having to lay off employees, but unfortunately, there wasn't enough work coming into the office to maintain the salaries. Most of my best clients have been, you know, I guess the bonus babies of times past. They're lucky enough to have a job to go to every day at this point.
They're not shopping much these days by the look of the town's main retail strip, Greenwich Avenue. Several stores have closed in the last few months. Even people who still have money are either afraid or embarrassed to spend it. Jim Mendelson is finance manager at one of Greenwich's many luxury car dealerships.
There was a customer who traded in a top-of-the-line Rolls-Royce for a considerably less expensive car. Just wasn't appropriate for this time and age.
As bankers and hedge fund managers curb their lavish lifestyles, the town is cutting back, too. Revenue from real estate taxes and building permits has fallen.
We're down anywhere between $8 to $10 million in the current year.
Peter Tessie is first selectman of Greenwich. It's a bit like the mayor.
We're going to have to take what I consider to be fairly drastic steps and reduce headcount.
That means laying off as many as 60 town workers. Projects like a new community pool and a school auditorium are on hold. There's less money for nonprofits, too, from the art museum to the local United Way. Fundraising there is off about 7%, just as more people need its services. For all the wealth here, plenty of regular folks live in Greenwich. It's home to a few subsidized housing projects. And for some people, the downturn hasn't been all bad.
Chips!
Because you're going to eat chips at church.
In the modest Chickahominy section of town, Brody and Jennifer Tice get their children ready for choir practice. They're raising five kids on Jennifer's salary as a doctor's office manager, with a little help from Brody's student loans. He started law school last fall. He says the boom times passed his family by.
For us, the last 8 to 10 years have been a hardship. Every time, you know, we've done a little better, prices just went up. And it was, you know, it was this constant sense of playing catch-up that we were never going to quite pull off.
That's partly why he quit his job as a carpenter to become a lawyer. The Tice family rents a small house in a neighborhood where even homes that look out on the local dump sell for $1 million. Jennifer says it's been hard raising kids in a place where their wealthier friends travel by private jet or take class trips to places like the Galapagos Islands.
The children are so exposed to this constant barrage of where did you go on vacation? Oh, you know, we went skiing, we went here, we went there, and is a little bit tough at times to explain that, no, you know, there are a lot of other kids right down the street that are also not going.
In some ways, the recession has made things easier for the Tice family. They no longer have to explain when they can't afford something.
If anything, now that folks aren't spending money quite so freely, some of the prices have dropped. We actually found a rental that we'll be moving into next month, and it's so much more than we could have ever afforded during the boom years.
Tice says someday they would like to buy a home and set down some roots, but unless prices fall a lot further, it probably won't be in Greenwich. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, come on, do you think we just fell off the turnip truck? I know there's been all kinds of talk about shovel-ready projects and how they're all lined up just waiting for stimulus money, but this one is kind of ridiculous. As the president was signing the stimulus package today, Missouri transportation officials met at a bridge over the Missouri River just south of Jefferson City. Here's the turnip truck part. Before the ink was dry, standing right there on the bridge, they approved a retrofit, the construction cranes moved in, and thus they became the first project funded with stimulus money. Just to add on a soupçon of symbolism here, yes, of course, the bridge was built in 1933 with New Deal money. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 297 points, 3.75%. The NASDAQ down 63 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 lost 37 points. That's 4.5%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our morning report crew. Coming up next time on this program, dealing with decreased benefits during a recession.
When you're trying to put food on your table and you may be working two jobs and are dealing with an injury, veterans often take what they can get now, and oftentimes they end up getting much less of a benefit than they probably deserve.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.